It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here as we dive into the work of the nonprofit newsroom Wisconsin Watch, which published dozens of stories this year. Its guiding values are to protect the vulnerable, expose wrongdoing, and explore solutions. Join in with your questions about investigative journalism, your reaction to their podcast Open and Shut about the power of prosecutors. Did you listen? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dee Hall is co-founder of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism and managing editor of its news outlet, Wisconsin Watch. Dee, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
Well, let's take stock for a moment as the year wraps up. What is your assessment on the health of journalism, especially investigative journalism in Wisconsin?
Well, it's kind of a mixed picture. You have Gannett, which owns at least 10 newspapers, mostly in eastern Wisconsin, have gone through a series of buyouts and layoffs. At the same time, Wisconsin Watch is growing very rapidly due to, you know, the kind of funding that we rely on, which is major foundations and individual donations. And so, you know, we are doing well, but we are small compared to, you know, the number of reporters that used to report on issues in Wisconsin. So it's still a mixed picture, and it's one that should remain of concern to people. You know, journalism does need to be supported. Otherwise, it can fade away.
What is the role of nonprofit, nonpartisan newsrooms as we see this increasingly partisan divide in the media industry?
Well, we try to fill in the gaps that traditional media cannot get to, especially investigative and in-depth journalism. It's very expensive, as you can imagine, to spend weeks, sometimes months, in the case of our podcast, 3 years on a story. Or a series of stories. And most newsrooms are really not poised to do that. You know, they're just busy with their, you know, slimmed down staffs, just trying to cover the daily news in their own community. So that's the value that we bring to Wisconsin. Also, we collaborate with all kinds of for-profit and nonprofit news organizations in Wisconsin and nationally to bring the, you know, story of the important issues to Wisconsin. So we play somewhat of a unique role, kind of a hub role in terms of providing news that people can't get other places.
Well, let's look go more deeply on Open and Shut. Wisconsin Watch releasing its first podcast about the unchecked power of prosecutors. What did you learn about prosecutors through this extensive reporting?
So the goal with the podcast was really to show that prosecutors are the single most powerful actors in the criminal justice system. A lot of people think judges are important, police officers. They all play an important role, but it's prosecutors who decide whether a crime is charged. And also, you know, what evidence will be gathered or hidden, let's say, when it comes to prosecuting a person for something they have allegedly done. So we looked at this through a series of cases in northeastern Wisconsin, in Winnebago and Outagamie counties, former prosecutors, and some of the cases that they handled that raised questions about whether they had followed the rules that prosecutors are supposed to follow.
Wisconsin Watch found that, you know, judges in Wisconsin have among the widest latitude in the country to, you know, send defendants to jail or to impose fines or place someone on probation. Why is that? Why is there such power?
So that was some earlier reporting we did that we also incorporated in the podcast. It has to do with the judge's ability to sort of craft a sentence that they think is fair. A lot of places, a lot of states have mandatory minimums or maximum. We do have maximum penalties, but mandatory minimums. This is just, it's really a function of state law. If your state has guardrails around what judges can do, then they must follow those rules. If they don't have the guardrails, then judges have more discretion to impose sentences that they think are fair.
Talking about the 2022 investigative reporting by Wisconsin Watch with the news outlet's managing editor, Dee Hall, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Joe is joining us from Adams Friendship area. Joe, hi. What would you like to bring up?
I would just like to say thank you to Dee Hall. She's the reason I'm innocent and free today.
Wow. Could you elaborate at all? What occurred?
The district attorney in Marquette County prosecuted me for a crime that never happened. He prosecuted me for arson with intent to defraud, and he worked with my insurance company to deliberately incarcerate me, and they all knew it was an electrical fire, but they didn't care because the insurance company got to pay if I'm guilty.
Mm. Joe, thank you for calling in. Dee, can you elaborate on the reporting work here?
Well, really great to hear your voice again, Joe. So this was a story I did about 10 years ago when I was working for the Wisconsin State Journal. It was actually a series of stories, and it showed how private insurance companies had an extraordinary role when it came to determining whether a person would be charged with arson. And a lot of their work was based, some of their work was based on really flawed forensics, indications of arson that really are also found in any kind of accidental, or in this case, an electrical fire. So I wrote a four-part series about Joe's case in Marquette County, and he was picked up by a pretty prominent Madison defense attorney, and they were able to get him exonerated and freed from Oak Hill Correctional.
The ripple effect many years later that you can hear right there.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling in, Joe. That's great.
Does Wisconsin Watch plan to produce more podcasts?
Well, that's an interesting question. This was such a massive effort that really strained the resources of our organization and required, lots of outside funding to bring it to fruition. So it is something that we will consider, but it is a massive undertaking, as I think WPR knows, since they were our partner in this podcast. So it's something we will consider. It is part of what we try to do, which is tell the stories in the formats that we think are most conducive to that story. So sometimes it's an audio report. Sometimes it's a long form investigative story. In this case, it's a podcast. Sometimes we do photos is the primary way that we convey a story or a message.
Let's switch gears here to PFAS, forever chemicals. In September, Wisconsin Watch contributed to reporting project on groundwater contamination. What challenges do you see PFAS creating for Wisconsin communities, and what has your reporting dug up?
Well, this is happening all over the state, that these so-called forever chemicals, as you just heard on the newscast, are turning up in private wells and in municipal water systems all over the place. It's a rapidly growing story because it's something that people hadn't paid a lot of attention to until the last year or two. So there's a lot going on around PFAS. The state of Wisconsin is considering regulations on PFAS. They've set a maximum limit. As you can hear, the state is trying to call in EPA to help out with some of these individual cases. So it's a big moving picture right now. And we are focused on PFAS as part of our participation in the Mississippi River Basin Ag and Water Desk. And it's a 10-reporter collaborative involving multiple newsrooms. We're focused on the issues, environmental and agricultural issues that confront the big swath of the Midwest that drains into the Mississippi River. And so this is our reporter, Bennett Goldstein, is focused a lot on PFAS, other issues, but he wrote that story about the town of Campbell and the PFAS that's been found in all of their drinking water.
Where does investigative reporting go next on PFAS?
Well, I mean, there's so many pieces to follow. Mm-hmm. There's the regulatory part of it. There's the emerging science about it. We did a whole story also by Bennett about how to remove PFAS if you have them in your water. There are multiple filtration systems and some questions about how well any of them works. But, and then people are researching that. What is the best way to get rid of it? What's the best way to get rid of the filters that took the PFAS out? Because those are also hazardous. So there's a lot to follow.
D, Dee Hall is managing editor of Wisconsin Watch as we tour through the groundbreaking work from this nonprofit newsroom in 2022. Call in with your questions, your thoughts about these investigations, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with the managing editor of the nonprofit newsroom Wisconsin Watch, highlighting some of the 60 stories they published this year. Call in with your questions for Wisconsin Watch. Share the investigative stories that stuck with you this year, where you want investigative reporting to go next, 800-642-1234. Dee Hall of Wisconsin Watch stays with us. Let's take another call. Karen is joining us from Green Bay. Karen, hi. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Okay, I have a question. There's a legislator in Madison who was there's an incident of child abuse that he and his wife had done child abuse to their child. And I felt that that case was just sort of thrown away. And I worked in the schools, and I saw parents who had consequences for things they had done, and it was far less than what this legislator had done to his child. And I'm wondering what happened there. It just really makes me angry because, I did reporting, as a mandatory reporter, and I saw results of parents that hadn't done anything as bad as this legislator did.
Karen, thank you for your call. Dee, can you fill in here?
I think she might be referring to some stories that were done by the Green Bay Press Gazette. And
yes.
I'm not going to mention the lawmaker because I'm not entirely sure. It's just off the top of my head. But I think the story really did focus on questions about the disparate treatment that this particular lawmaker received versus a regular person who's not in public office. And this happened, I believe, before the person was in public office, although I'm not entirely certain about that. But I think those are the kinds of stories that, as you can hear from the passion in her voice, people wonder about. They wonder, why does this rich and powerful or powerful person get different treatment from a regular person, anybody else who would be in that same circumstance? And so that's a classic kind of investigative journalism situation where we look at disparate treatment of people with and without power. Thanks for bringing up that story. I agree. Maybe it didn't get as much traction as it should have, but it was a very well done story.
Wisconsin Watch continued reporting this year on a former UW-Madison pediatrician named Barbara Knox. What happened involving Dr. Knox that drew your attention?
So we started investigating Knox back in the Royal We. It was actually me who started the story, and then we've had a couple other reporters on the story. Started back in 2019, just before the pandemic hit. I'd gotten a tip from a family that said that they had been accused of child abuse after they brought their child into American Family Children's Hospital here in Madison. And the child had actually been handled, in the emergency room. And that's where he ended up with some of these little tiny fingerprint type bruises as they held him down and try to get a needle into him. This is a woman who is a teacher. Her husband also works in the school system, and they were just flabbergasted by how they could go from being these, great parents to suddenly they're both, suspiciously looked at as abusers. And in their case, what happened was the local police department, this is Mount Horeb, quickly, walked into the hospital and said, yeah, this is there's nothing here. It took the child welfare authorities a little longer to reach that same conclusion, but it left the mom in that case really furious about what she assumed was probably happening to a lot of people. So then we They had already reached out. The family had already reached out to multiple people who had contacted them, you know, people they found on social media who'd had similar experiences to theirs of being wrongly accused of abuse. And so I started with that list and then developed other people who came forward, realized over time. We did a search of all court cases and found that Dr. Knox had been involved in over 200 court cases.
Wow.
She was often the state's expert, you know, but what we also found is that in numerous cases, other doctors, prosecutors, judges, juries had rejected her diagnoses of abuse and found that the children had either illnesses or accidents that had caused their injuries. And so, you know, she's now left Wisconsin. She went to Alaska. She left there under similar circumstances, which is allegations of bullying coworkers and alleged misdiagnoses. Some of the parents from Alaska are now suing her for alleged misdiagnoses. And so that's why we're still tracking, you know, the story, because there are people who remain in prison today. There are people who suffered injury in years past because of what they say are misdiagnoses by Dr. Knox.
We talked this year on our program about the impact of junk science with a litigator at the Innocence Project. Can you connect wrongful diagnoses of child abuse to what this is, junk science is?
Well, I know that in one of our stories, we pointed out that a judge in New Jersey recently labeled the diagnosis of abusive head trauma, which is sort of a part of a family of diagnoses, including shaken baby syndrome, in which the judge concluded after hearing from numerous medical experts that this was junk science. Now, several of the cases we wrote about, in fact, did involve so-called abusive head trauma. It is recognized by the American Academy of Pediatrics. It is considered a mainstream diagnosis. But through these court cases, there have been a lot of questions raised. Prime among them is why these children who supposedly have somehow gotten abusive head trauma, most of them have no bruises, no bumps, nothing. Somehow their brain has swelled. And child abuse pediatricians sometimes assume, well, that's because they somehow were shaken or thrown against a soft surface. But in many cases, it can be traced back to a medical condition, like a brain bleed that maybe even was started at birth. So from birth trauma. So those are the kind of questions that we raised in our stories and that are being raised in a lot of these court cases today.
Talking about some of the 2022 reporting projects of Wisconsin Watch with its managing editor, Dee Hall, you can join in 800-642-1234. Let's turn to election coverage. Your election coverage included stories about redistricting and ballot security, voting restrictions. Why report on how elections take place rather than the individual candidates in the race?
So that's part of our strategy of kind of being where the other news media aren't necessarily. Hmm. You know, WPR does a great job of covering the races. The Wisconsin State Journal, Journal Sentinel, local TV, they do a good job of just doing the blow-by-blow, coverage of as the election goes along, polls and such. So we try to be in spots that the other mainstream media are not. And so one of the things we wanted to look at, for example, is we looked at what is the impact of gerrymandering on this election versus previous elections, where the maps that we have now have actually even been changed since the first, major redistricting in 2011. In 2021, they were changed again. And so our reporter and State House editor, Matthew DeFore, took a look. What happened? You know, are these maps as skewed as they were when they were among the most skewed in the country in the last election? And what he found was they're actually a little bit more skewed based on his analysis and discussion with some experts. That's why we write about those things, is because they take more time to do, and they're not things that, especially if you're out on the campaign trail and you're covering the latest from Tony Evers or Tim Michaels or Mandela Barnes or Ron Johnson, that you just don't necessarily have time to sit back and take a look at some of these other issues.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That makes sense. You also brought up municipal clerks and how they prepare for elections.
Yeah, so Jacob Resnick, our Report for America reporter, who also is part of the State House Bureau, he took a look at how municipal clerks were preparing because of all of the rancor around elections ever since the 2020 election. And, you know, he went some of the people were talking about how they were having a hard time getting people to man the polls, although it turned out that in 2022, we did have enough people at the polls. You know, there were some places that were really doing a lot of critical incident training in case some person came to the polls, which did happen in Wisconsin at one polling place, and that person was arrested. You know, somebody was armed and was threatening people in the city of Stoughton, which is near south of Madison. They installed trauma kits, you know, not just regular first aid kits. So let's, really ready for something bad.
Let's pause there. Dee Hall, co-founder, managing editor of Wisconsin Watch. We'll pick this up. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the work of a nonprofit newsroom in our state called Wisconsin Watch and discuss more broadly how this reporting helps to fill news and information gaps, as we've been talking about, provides solutions and fixes, and keeps communities in our state informed and people in power held accountable. The number to call to talk about the effects and the efforts of nonprofit journalism, the work of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, call in now at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We have Wisconsin Watch managing editor Dee Hall, who stays with us. Dee, we heard from Timothy in Madison, called in and would like you to elaborate on your reporting around concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs. Timothy is asking, what are the challenges for the state to regulate CAFOs over groundwater contamination? And what is the future of manure pollution reporting in this area?
So, yes, we've done a lot of stories, most of them in previous years, but there's a huge tension between the movement of dairy farms to become larger and larger and the need to protect local groundwater, ground and surface water sources. Some of these concentrated animal feeding operations are very large, and they produce many, you know, as much manure, as much waste as big cities, and yet they're located in these small rural areas. There's a tension between local governments, like town governments. There are some town governments that have tried to regulate this and they've gotten sued, the results are mixed. Then you have individuals whose wells may be tainted, and there is some amount of money to get a new well, but there is very little that an individual can do, you know, just to stop the pollution. So it's a source of great conflict and you know, great debate on the state level as they're trying to figure out how to implement rules that would be fair to everyone and still, you know, safeguard both drinking water and surface and groundwater.
Let's move to Keel. Wisconsin Watch reported multiple stories about this community of Keel response to school bullying. Keel in the northwestern was part of our state. What happened there?
So we did two stories, and they revolve around two different alleged bullying cases. One involved a transgender student in the middle school. The other involved a Black high school student who was bullied. And what happened was that the district, as required by law, responded to these complaints. And in the case of the Black high school student, you know, began to do some training and some education around race to try to make Keel a more welcoming place for people of color. That created a backlash that started about 2020. That created a big backlash. You know, there were allegations that they were teaching this thing called critical race theory in the schools. They weren't, but that was the allegation. There was concern, you know, and it got bad enough where the student, who was a high school football player, ended up just transferring to the Fond du Lac district. He just left town and had to, you know, it's like 45 minutes away. And so you know, we told the story of that student and how this all spooled out, you know, as essentially the bullying that happened to him was proven. It was in text messages, and it was clear what had happened, but it just ignited this culture war in Kiel. And then fast forward to 2022, there was another alleged bullying incident involving a transgender student. The conservative law firm, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, picked up that case on behalf of the parents of a set of students who were accused of bullying the student. They put out the story that the entire case had to do with the wrong use of pronouns for the student. But, you know, there's evidence and information that it was much more extensive than that. And so that ended up becoming a national story. There were bomb threats that were sent to the school district, and they had to close schools at the end of the 2022 school district. So in May, they had to close schools.
So as you talk about this culture war in Kiel and, you know, critical race theory asserting that white supremacy from our country's past is living on in laws and systems and institutions, you know, what effect is that having on communities as there is this clash? I mean, here in Kiel, you're reporting on this firm training about racism and harassment, and then you see that backlash.
Well, it's actually part of a very strategic, it's part of a national strategy, both anti-trans and, you know, and anti-quote CRT, which basically is now encompasses any amount of, you know, training or education about racial discrimination. But it's being somewhat cynically deployed, I would say, based on our reporting. We did some other stories around this that show that it's part of a strategy that conservatives were using to try to whip people into a frenzy over some culture war type issues in an effort to convince them that everything's going to heck and they need to come out and vote for candidate X. You know, it was at play in the Kiel school board race all the way up to the state, you know, the governor's race, where, you know, Tim Michaels used the commonly used phrase, we want ABCs, not CRT. So mm-hmm. So it's kind of infused the political world.
Talking about the 2022 investigative reporting by Wisconsin Watch, which with managing editor Dee Hall, you can join in along the way at 800-642-1234. Dee, let's go to Beyond Hunger. You taught a class of journalism students at UW-Madison who produced this 10-part series called Beyond Hunger. What did that series bring to light about food insecurity?
Well, first of all, it's pretty extensive in Wisconsin. One out of every 12 people is food insecure, meaning they're not sure where their next meal is going to come from. They're not 100% sure they're going to have enough money to feed their family. And then we looked at food insecurity from a whole bunch of perspectives. We looked at food waste, for example. We looked at the grow your own movement. We looked at even the manufactured food movement, which has to do with cultured meat and cultivated meat, which is right now in the laboratory stage, but expected to burst out into the into your grocery store in coming years. And, you know, we also found that the current system for applying for and qualifying for food share, for example, is very complicated. We even interviewed the former head of the food share program for Wisconsin, who just said she just got very frustrated that she couldn't make it more streamlined and easier to access for people who need it. So it's kind of a whole variety of things that we covered.
Hmm. What response did you get from students who worked on the reporting project? Because in the past, you know, we've also seen how food insecurity affects college students.
Right. Yeah. So there were actually at least one or two students in the class who are themselves somewhat food insecure. You know, they receive food share benefits. So that was a good insight for them to have. But I think the main reaction was that there were issues out there that they weren't even all that aware of, and also some solutions out there that were not getting enough attention. And so that's one thing we do try to focus on, solutions, because if you just have a drumbeat of bad news with no solutions, people become somewhat hopeless. But, you know, this is a solvable problem. And in one of the aspects of the reporting, I think that was interesting, is it showed how food insecurity plummeted during the pandemic because the federal government stepped in and made so much more food available to students and to families and really pumped money into that to make sure people didn't go hungry. So it's a problem it turns out we can actually solve. And so that's one thing I really liked about the series. We did do a lot of the reporting focused on how can we do better.
Right. Aside from the federal government's pandemic aid lifting up families, what were some of the other AHA solution moments that you can tell us about?
We did a whole story about food deserts, and we talked about, you know, why are there food deserts? And it turns out the economics of putting a grocery store in a community are pretty brutal. It's like a 1% margin, you know, profit margin, and that makes it really hard for major companies or any companies, honestly, to come in and provide groceries in a community unless they can be sure that they're going to have a certain amount of sales and a certain amount of profit. So that was one of those moments. There were some others. You know, there's a mobile market operating in a couple of communities, including with Milwaukee, where the healthy food is brought to the neighborhood. The neighborhood may lack a grocery store, but then the market comes in. Now, that's one of those where the solution is very expensive, and it's not really necessarily scalable at this moment, but it kind of offers some insights into what is possible.
Did you learn how extensive are food deserts in Wisconsin?
Yes, and I'm trying to remember that figure now. But they're in urban and rural areas, which is interesting. We looked at Florence County and the county seat of Florence. It lost its only grocery store several years ago. And so people had to literally drive into Michigan to get groceries. And what happened was the state, I think it was the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, gave a subsidy to a local grocer to keep the lights on, to keep that store in town. And so, you know, there are solutions, and some of them aren't that expensive to help people who are suffering from this.
Dee Hall is co-founder and managing editor of Wisconsin Watch, co-creator of their podcast Open and Shut about the unchecked power of prosecutors. Still time to bring your questions, your thoughts about investigative reporting this year. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about the nonprofit newsroom Wisconsin Watch. They have dozens of national, regional, and state awards over the years, published 60 stories this year. We take a look back at what some of their investigations revealed. And still time to talk about local investigative journalism. 800-642-1234. Dee Hall is Wisconsin Watch's co-founder and managing editor. Stays with us. Dee, I want to talk about Wisconsin Watch digging into the Unborn Child Protection Act in Wisconsin and your investigative reporter, Phoebe Petrovic, who wrote about this law. Wisconsin is one of five states that allows civil detention for pregnant people accused of substance abuse. What are the concerns around this law?
So the main concern is fairness, of course. You know, there was a woman we featured in this story who ended up suing the state over this law. She had tested possible for some drug use. She acknowledged past drug use, but said that as soon as she found out she was pregnant, she stopped using. Well, local authorities didn't believe her, and they subjected her to a series of court orders and mandatory treatment and eventually jail because she just refused to go along with this system. She thought it was so unfair. The story is told through sort of her eyes and what she went through. And, you know, this law is unusual in one aspect, which is that we are among the few states that allow civil detention for pregnant people accused of substance abuse use. However, the theme of the law is actually quite common. 44 states have some version of this where authorities are able to, you know, try to coerce or get women or people who are pregnant to go into treatment if substance use is suspected or proven. The problem with the law that we found is that the forced treatment basically doesn't work. Treatment generally works if people want to get better and want to be treated, or in the case of Tamara Lorcher, who we wrote about, actually have a substance abuse problem. So what we did was we did a big story about, you know, how the law works. There are over 300 people who are pregnant every year in Wisconsin who are subjected to this Act 262 in terms of, you know, actual court hearings to determine whether or not they are, you know, can be ordered into treatment. The second story we did looked at how you can do it better. Like, if we didn't have Act 262, how would experts in this field, experts in obstetrics and gynecology, experts in substance use, there's one expert we had who was an expert in both, how they would handle it. And it's a really different picture.
So with this law, you also looked into what could be the impact, as we saw the fall of Roe v. Wade and, you know, Wisconsin's 1849 abortion ban. What influence or ripple effect do you see there?
Well, one of the people we talked to felt that this, the fact that it's harder for women to get an abortion, may be leading some people who have drug or alcohol problems to continue with a pregnancy that they don't want, but which would also subject them to this law, which could force them into treatment. And so, you know, that's speculative. We don't know. The 1849 law has not been in effect for very long. We don't know whether that's the case, but that was one concern, is that in the past, women who had significant drug or alcohol problems may have opted to have an abortion, and now that option is removed from some folks because they don't have the transportation or the means to go elsewhere.
Okay. Let's bring on another call. Winona in Sun Prairie. Hi, Winona. Go ahead.
First of all, thank you so much for the work that you do. This is really important. I have two questions, but we might only have time for one. The first question is about how long does it take for your organization to do an investigation and make a decision about how much more you should pursue the issue, or maybe figure out there's nothing there?
Does that
make sense to you?
That's a great question. When do you stop reporting? I think in essence is what you're saying, Winona.
Yeah, and when do you stop investigating?
Investigating,
that's the
right.
Other piece of it.
Yes. Why don't we get Dito to weigh in on that first?
Sure. So the issue is, it comes up every day for us. We look at, who does this affect? Are there a lot of people affected? Could this be a statewide problem? We are a statewide news organization, so we look at that. Are vulnerable people being taken advantage of in some way because of a broken or failing system? Are other media already investigating this, in which case we would help them, you know, and pass along tips that we get that are within the wheelhouse of that news organization? For example, when Caitlin Farrell was at the Capital Times, if we got any you know, complaints about sexual assault in the military or the reserve, we would send them to Caitlin. You know, when Patrick Marley was investigating Lincoln Hills, if we got tips about Lincoln Hills, we'd send them to him, because we don't want to duplicate the work that's already happening. The other thing is, you know, is there documentation? Is there proof that this thing that a person says is happening? And if so, is it something we can actually shed light on? Those are kind of two different things, but they're intertwined. So those are some of the things we look at.
That helps. Winona, we have time for Q2. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm curious about if you could talk a little bit about how your attitude about people or society may have changed over the years, the more you do this work. Have you found you're more cynical, more curious? I don't want to put words in your mouth. It might not have changed at all, but I bet it did.
Oh, I try not to be cynical, but skeptical. That's always it might be a small distinction, but yeah, I mean, I guess I've seen all kinds of people who do really, really terrible and awful things, you know, people who are powerful and do terrible and awful things. And that doesn't make me think that every powerful person is terrible, nor that every victim is truly blameless in whatever situation they're in. So I guess it's probably given me a nuanced view of humanity, which is not cynical, but at times skeptical. I haven't given up on people, still like them. but yeah, I mean, we do look very closely at people in power, and are they wielding their power in a responsible way? Are they harming people just for their own personal benefit? Those are the kind of people that we do take a really close look at, because they are not, they're not contributing to society. They're harming people. So I don't know, I guess I remain hopeful, and I'm still a believer in the human race, but it does expose you to a lot of information that if you weren't in journalism, you might never see.
Well, Nona, thanks for those great questions. Dee, let's look ahead now. Wisconsin Watch is joining a nationwide project to protect democracy by limiting the spread and impact of misinformation, or working on that. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, I'm so excited about this. Starting early next year, we will be starting to cover disinformation with a full-time disinformation beat. We are part of a big research project funded by the National Science Foundation called Course Correct, and it is being led out of UW-Madison. And so we are going to be, to some extent, the guinea pigs. They are going to study us and our efforts to cover disinformation and figure out how well do those efforts work and which efforts work. It's somewhat hands-off from their end. They're giving us enough money to have somebody cover disinformation for at least a year and a half, but they're not going to tell us what to write or how to write it or when to do it. And then they'll just see, they're developing a tool as part of this research project that we will then use to see whether it's useful. And then again, they will use our experience. Does it work? Does it not work? To figure out, how to create a tool that the public and the media can use to catch disinformation at a very early stage and possibly head off the spread. Because as you know, it's the old saying of a lie is halfway around the world before the truth gets its shoes on. We're trying to figure out a way for the truth to get its shoes on faster and to catch up with the lies as they're racing around the world.
Wow, that's really an ambitious question. Effort there to trying to figure out how you measure that and its impact and how reporting can actually have a ripple effect there. So we will definitely be watching that. Dee, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for sharing this reporting and what you do at Wisconsin Watch.
All right. Thanks for having me again.
Dee Hall is co-founder and managing editor of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, also known as Wisconsin Watch. We have a link to its top 2022 stories list at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.